the published scientific reports. This evidence then goes to the regulators, whose job is to decide whether to allow the drug onto the market. But in the United States, 40% of the regulators' wages are paid by the drug companies, while in Britain it's 100%. When a society is trying to figure out which drug is safe to put on the market, there are meant to be two teams, the drug company making the case for it, and the referee working for us, the public, figuring out if it properly works. But Professor Ioannidis was telling me that in this match, the referee is paid by the drug company team, and that team almost always wins. The rules they've written are designed to make it extraordinarily easy to get a drug approved. All you have to do is to produce two trials, anytime, anywhere in the world, that suggest some positive effect of the drug. If there are two, and there is some effect, that's enough. So you can have a situation where there are 1,000 scientific trials, and 998 find that the drug doesn't work at all, and two find there is a tiny effect, and that means the drug will be making its way to your local pharmacy. I think this is a field that is seriously sick, Professor Ioannidis told me. The field is just sick and bought and corrupted, and I can't describe it otherwise. I asked him how it made him feel to have learned all of this. It's depressing, he said. That's ironic, I replied. Well, it's not so depressing, he responded, to the severe extent that I would take SSRI antidepressants. I tried to laugh, but it caught in my throat. Some people said to Irving, so what? Okay, so say it's a placebo effect. Whatever the reason, people still feel better. Why break the spell? He explained, the evidence from the clinical trials suggests that the antidepressant effects are largely a placebo, but the side effects are mostly the result of the chemicals themselves, and they can be very severe. Of course, Irving says, there's weight gain. I massively ballooned and saw the weight fall off almost as soon as I stopped. Irving continued, we know that SSRIs, this new type of antidepressants, in particular contribute to sexual dysfunction, and the rates for most SSRIs are around 75% of treatment-engendered sexual dysfunction. Though it's painful to talk about, this rang true for me too. In the years I was taking Paxil, I found my genitals were a lot less sensitive and it took a really long time to ejaculate. This made sex painful and it reduced the pleasure I took from it. It was only when I stopped taking the drug and I started having more pleasurable sex again that I remembered sex is one of the best natural antidepressants in the world. Irving continued, in young people, these chemical antidepressants increase the risk of suicide. There's a new Swedish study showing that it increases the risk of violent criminal behaviour. In older people, it increases the risk of death from all causes, including the risk of stroke. In everybody, it increases the risk of type 2 diabetes. In pregnant women, it increases the risk of miscarriage and of having children born with autism or physical deformities. So all of these things are known. And if you start experiencing these effects, it can be hard to stop. About 20% of people experience serious withdrawal symptoms. So, he says, if you want to use something to get its placebo effect, at least use something that's safe. We could be giving people the herb St. John's wort, Irving says, and we'd have all the positive placebo effects and none of these drawbacks. Although, of course, St. John's wort isn't patented by the drug companies, so nobody would be making much profit off it. By this time, Irving was starting, he told me softly, to feel guilty for having pushed these pills all these years. In 1802, John Haygarth revealed the true story of the wands to the public. Some people are really recovering from their pain for a time, he explained. But it's not because of the power of the wands, it's because of the power in their minds. It was a placebo effect, and it likely wouldn't last because it wasn't solving the underlying problem. This message angered almost everyone. Some felt duped by the people who'd sold them the expensive wands in the first place, but many more felt furious with Haygarth himself and said he was clearly talking rubbish. The intelligence excited great commotions accompanied by threats and abuse, he wrote. A counter-declaration was to be signed by a great number of very respectable persons, including some leading scientists of the day, explaining that the wand worked and its powers were physical and real. Since Irving published his early results, and he's built on them over the years, the reaction has been similar. Nobody denies that the drug company's own data, submitted to the FDA, show that antidepressants have only a really small effect over and above placebo. Nobody denies that my own drug company admitted privately that the drug I was given, Paxil, was not going to work for people like me, and they had to make a payout in court for their deception. But some scientists, a considerable number, do dispute many of Kirsch's wider arguments. I wanted to study carefully what they say. I hoped the old story could still somehow be saved. I turned to a man who, more than anyone else alive, successfully sold antidepressants to the wider public, and he did it because he believed it. He never took a cent from the drug companies. In the 1990s, Dr. Peter Kramer was watching as patient after patient walked into his therapy office in Rhode Island, transformed before his eyes after they were given the new antidepressant drugs. It's not just that they seemed to have improved, they became, he argued, better than well. They had more resilience and energy than the average person. The book he wrote about this, Listening to Prozac, became the best-selling book ever about antidepressants. I read it soon after I started taking the drugs. I was sure the process Peter described so compellingly was happening to me. I wrote about it, and I made his case to the public in articles and interviews. So when Irving started to present his evidence, Peter, by then a professor at Brown Medical School, was horrified. He started taking apart Irving's critique of antidepressants at length in public, both in books and in a series of charged public debates. His first argument is that Irving is not giving antidepressants enough time. The clinical trials he's analysed, almost all the ones submitted to the regulator, typically last for 4 to 8 weeks. But that isn't enough. It takes longer for these drugs to have a real effect. This seemed to me to be an important objection. Irving thought so too, so he looked to see if there were any drug trials that had lasted longer to find their results. It turns out there were two. And in the first, the placebo did the same as the drug. And in the second, the placebo did better. Peter then pointed to another mistake he believed Irving had made. The antidepressant trials that Irving is looking at lumped together two groups, moderately depressed people and severely depressed people. Maybe these drugs don't work so much for moderately depressed people, Peter concedes, but they do work for severely depressed people. He's seen it. So when Irving adds up an average for everyone, lumping together the mildly depressed and the severely depressed, the effects of the drug look small. But that's only because he's diluting the real effect, as surely as Coke will lose its flavour if you mix it with pints and pints of water. Again, Irving thought this was a potentially important point, and one he was keen to understand. So he went back over the studies he'd drawn his data from. He discovered, with a single exception, he'd looked only at studies of people classed as having very severe depression. This then led Peter to turn to his most powerful argument. It's the heart of his case against Irving and for antidepressants. In 2012, Peter went to watch some clinical trials being conducted in a medical centre that looked like a beautiful glass cube and gazed out over expensive houses. When the company there wants to conduct trials into antidepressants, they've got two headaches. They have to recruit volunteers who will swallow potentially dangerous pills over a sustained period of time, but they're restricted by law to paying only small amounts, between $40 and $75. At the same time, they have to find people who have very specific mental health disorders. For example, if you're doing a trial for depression, they have to have only depression and no other complicating factors. Given all that, it's pretty difficult for them to find anyone who'll take part, so they often turn to quite desperate people, and they have to offer other things to tempt them. Peter watched as poor people were bussed in from across the city to be offered a gorgeous buffet of care they'd never normally receive at home. Therapy, a whole community of people who'd listen to them, a warm place to be during the day, medication, and money that could double their poverty-level income. As he watched this, he was struck by something. The people who turn up at the centre have a strong incentive to pretend to have any condition they happen to be studying there, and the for-profit companies conducting the clinical trials have a strong incentive to pretend to believe them. Peter looked on as both sides seemed to be effectively bullshitting each other. When he saw people being asked to rate how well the drugs had worked, he thought they were often clearly just giving the interviewer whatever answer they wanted. So Peter concluded that the results from clinical trials of antidepressants, all the data we have, are meaningless. This means Irving is building his conclusion that their effect is very small at best, on a heap of garbage, Peter declared. The trials themselves are fraudulent. It's a devastating point, and Peter has proved it quite powerfully. But it puzzled Irving when he heard it, and it puzzled me. The leading scientific defender of antidepressants, Peter Kramer, is making the case for them by saying that the scientific evidence for them is junk. When I spoke to Peter, I told him that if he's right, and I think he is, then that's not a case for the drugs, it's a case against them. It means that by law they should never have been brought to market. When I started to ask about this in a friendly tone, Peter became quite irritable and said that even bad trials can yield usable results. He soon changed the subject. Given that he put so much weight on what he's seen with his own eyes, I asked Peter what he would say to the people who claim that John Haygarth's wand worked, because they too were just believing what they saw with their own eyes. He said that in cases like that, the collection of experts isn't as expert or as numerous as what we're talking about here. I mean, this would just be an orders of magnitude bigger scandal if these were just like bones wrapped in cloth. Shortly after that, he said, "I think I want to cut off this conversation." Even Peter Kramer had one note of caution to offer about these drugs. He stressed to me that the evidence he has seen only makes the case for prescribing antidepressants for 6 to 20 weeks. Beyond that, he said, "I think the evidence is thinner, and my dedication to the arguments is less as you get to long-term use. I mean, does anyone really know about what 14 years of use does in terms of harm and benefit? I think the answer is we don't really know." I felt anxious as he said that. I'd already told him that I used the drugs for almost that long. "Perhaps because he sensed my anxiety," he said. "Although I do think we've been reasonably lucky. People like you come off and function." Very few scientists now defend the idea that depression is simply caused by low levels of serotonin. But the debate about whether chemical antidepressants work, for some other reason we don't fully understand, is still ongoing. There is no scientific consensus. Many distinguished scientists agree with Irving Kirsch. Many agree with Peter Kramer. I wasn't sure what to take away from all of this, until Irving led me to one last piece of evidence. I think it tells us the most important fact we need to know about chemical antidepressants. In the late 1990s, a group of scientists wanted to test the effects of the new SSRI antidepressants in a situation that wasn't just a lab or a clinical trial. They wanted to look at what happens in a more everyday situation. So they set up something called the STAR-D trial. It was pretty simple. A normal patient goes to the doctor and explains he's depressed. The doctor talks through the options with him, and if they both agree, he starts taking an antidepressant. At this point, the scientists conducting the trial start to monitor the patient. If the antidepressant doesn't work for him, he's given another one. If that one doesn't work, he's given another one. And on until he gets one that feels as though it works. This is how it works for most of us out here in the real world. A majority of people who get prescribed antidepressants try more than one, or try more than one dosage until they find the effects they're looking for. And what the trial found is, the drugs worked. Some 67% of patients did feel better, just like I did in those first few months. But then they found something else. Within a year, half of the patients were fully depressed again. Only 1 in 3 of the people who stayed on the pills had a lasting, proper recovery from their depression. And even that exaggerates the effect, since we know that many of these people would have recovered naturally without the pills. It seemed like my story played out line by line. I felt better at first, the effect wore off, I tried increasing the dose, and then that wore off too. When I realized that antidepressants weren't working for me anymore, that no matter how much I jacked up the dose, the sadness would still seep back through, I assumed there was something wrong with me. Now I was reading the STAR-D trial's results, and I realized I was normal. My experience was straight from the textbook. Far from being an outlier, I had the typical antidepressant experience. This evidence has been followed up several times since, and the proportion of people on antidepressants who continue to be depressed is found to be between 65 and 80%. To me, this seems like the most crucial piece of evidence about antidepressants of all. Most people on these drugs, after an initial kick, remain anxious or depressed. I want to stress, some reputable scientists still believe that these drugs genuinely work for a minority of people who take them due to a real chemical effect. That is possible. Chemical antidepressants may well be a partial solution for a minority of depressed and anxious people. I certainly don't want to take away anything that's giving relief to anyone. If you feel helped by them, and the positives outweigh the side effects, you should carry on. But it's impossible, in the face of all this evidence, to say that they are enough for a big majority of depressed and anxious people. I couldn't deny it any longer. For the vast majority, we clearly need a different story about what is making us feel this way, and a different set of solutions. But what, I asked myself, bewildered, could they be? Chapter 3, The Grief Exception. Ironically, Learning that depression and anxiety are not caused by a chemical imbalance made me feel unbalanced. Somebody once told me that giving a person a story about why they're in pain is one of the most powerful things you can ever do. Taking away the story for your pain is just as powerful. I felt like I was on a rocky ship and someone had taken away the railings. I began searching for another story. It was only some time later, when I first spoke with a woman in Arizona named Joanne Cassiatore, that I began to see the first thread of a different way of thinking about this problem, one that would transform the journey I was about to take. "Oh, honey," Joanne's doctor said to her, "you just need some attention." She'd been having extremely painful contractions for 3 weeks, and she thought she needed help. She was very diligent during her pregnancy. She wouldn't even chew gum with aspartame in it because she was worried it might harm her baby. So she kept insisting, "These are really painful contractions. They don't feel normal to me." But the doctor insisted right back to her, "It's normal." When she finally did go into the hospital to give birth, "I'd had 3 other children, so I knew what the labor room was supposed to sound like," she says. And so she sensed quite quickly that there was something wrong. There was chaos all around her, and the medical team was visibly panicked. She would have a contraction that lasted for a minute, then 30 seconds later she'd have another contraction. And as she pushed as hard as she physically could, they told her that they had lost the baby's heartbeat. She tried to push even more violently, and she felt like she was leaving her body and looking down on herself. I remember looking at myself. My legs were shaking, just shaking. I couldn't stop quivering. I had my eyes closed tightly when she was born, because I was going to get her out as quickly as I could. As soon as the baby emerged, the doctors made a decision, without asking Joanne, not to try to revive her. They handed her to Joanne's then husband, and he said gently to her, "We have a beautiful little girl." At that moment, I just sat up, Joanne told me years later. I became a mother to her in that moment, and I reached my hands out. I said, "Give her to me." She was perfect. She was 8 pounds. She had rolls of fat under her cheeks. Her little wrists had little rolls of fat. And he put her in my arms. She just looked asleep. It was a strange juxtaposition of birth and death that coalesced in a single moment. And that would change the course of my life. "No, I will tell you," she said to me. "I've had a lot of loss in my life. Before I even turned 40, I'd lost both my parents. I lost my best friend. But I never expected to lose my daughter. That's something I just couldn't have prepared myself for. It's just unfathomable." 3 months after her daughter died, Joanne weighed 88 pounds. "I wasn't sure I was going to make it," she said. "I felt like I was dying. Every day I would open my eyes, if I slept, and say, 'I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I don't want to feel like this anymore. I can't do this anymore.'" The autopsy was inconclusive. She didn't have any congenital problems. My best guess is that I think my body was trying to go into labor, but I wasn't dilating. The only thing I could think of is that my body killed her, just literally suffocated her to death. So I had a pretty acrimonious relationship with my body for a long time, as you can imagine. The only person I had to blame was me, my body. I was supposed to do one thing, give birth to this healthy baby. And she was healthy, so it wasn't her problem. It was my problem. Something in my body failed. I used to call my body Judas, because I felt like it betrayed her, and thus me. Over the years that followed, Joanne trained as a clinical psychologist and eventually became a professor of social work at Arizona State University. Her speciality was traumatic bereavement, people who've lost loved ones in the worst possible circumstances. As she treated many people who'd gone through experiences like hers, she noticed something peculiar. Very soon after they went through the death of a loved one, lots of her patients were being diagnosed by psychiatrists with clinical depression and being given very powerful psychiatric drugs. This was becoming routine. So if, say, your child was murdered, you were told you were clinically unwell and needed to have your brain chemistry fixed. For example, one of her patients, whose child had died recently, told her doctor that she sometimes felt her child was speaking to her. It didn't distress her. She felt mildly comforted by it. Yet the patient was immediately diagnosed with psychosis and given antipsychotic drugs. Joanne noticed that when her patients were given these diagnoses, they would, as she put it, start questioning their own feelings and doubting themselves, and that causes them to hide more. After seeing this happen more times than she could count, she began to investigate how depression is diagnosed, and to publish scientific papers on one aspect of it in particular. The way doctors are supposed to identify depression is laid out in the United States in something called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, which has appeared in 5 different editions now and is written by panels of psychiatrists. This is the Bible used by almost all US general practitioners when they diagnose depression or anxiety, and it's hugely influential across the world. To get a diagnosis of depression, you have to show at least 5 out of 9 symptoms nearly every day. For example, depressed mood, decreased interest in pleasure, or feelings of worthlessness. But as doctors started to apply this checklist, they discovered something awkward. Almost everybody who is grieving, it turns out, matches the clinical criteria for depression. If you simply use the checklist, virtually anyone who has lost someone should be diagnosed as having a clear mental illness. This made many doctors and psychiatrists feel uncomfortable, so the authors of the DSM invented a loophole, which became known as the grief exception. They said that you are allowed to show the symptoms of depression and not be considered mentally ill in one circumstance and one circumstance only, if you have recently suffered the loss of somebody close to you. After you lose, say, a baby, a sister, or a mother, you can show these symptoms for a year before you're classed as mentally ill. But if you continue to be profoundly distressed after this deadline, you will still be classified as having a mental disorder. As the years passed and different versions of the DSM were published, the time limit changed. It was slashed to 3 months, 1 month, and eventually just 2 weeks. To me, it's the greatest insult, Joanne told me. It's not just an insult to grief and to the relationship with the person who has died, but it's an insult to love. I mean, why do we grieve? If my neighbour across the street died, and I don't know my neighbour, I might say, oh, that's sad for his family, but I don't grieve. But when I love the person, I grieve. We grieve because we have loved. To say that if grief lasts beyond an artificial time limit, then it's a pathology, a disease to be treated with drugs, is, she believes, to deny the core of being human. Joanne had a patient whose daughter was abducted from the park during her first semester at college and burned alive. How can we tell that mother that she has a mental health problem, she asked me, because she's still in agony about it many years later. Yet that is what the DSM says. Far from being irrational, Joanne says, the pain of grief is necessary. I don't even want to recover from her death, she says about her daughter Cheyenne. Staying connected to the pain of her death helps me to do my work with such a full, compassionate heart and to live as fully as she can. I integrated that shame and guilt I felt and the betrayal by serving others, she said to me, with some of the horses she has rescued running in a field behind her. So in a way, my service to others is how I remunerate. It's my way of saying sorry to her every day. I'm sorry I didn't bring you safely into the world. And because of that, I'm going to bring your love into the world. It made her understand the pain of others in a way she couldn't before. It makes me stronger, she says, even in my vulnerable places. The grief exception revealed something that the authors of the DSM, the distillation of mainstream psychiatric thinking, were deeply uncomfortable with. They had been forced to admit, in their own official manual, that it's reasonable, and perhaps even necessary, to show the symptoms of depression in one set of circumstances. But once you've conceded that, it invites an obvious follow-on question. Why is a death the only event that can happen in life where depression is a reasonable response? Why not if your husband has left you after 30 years of marriage? Why not if you're trapped for the next 30 years in a meaningless job you hate? Why not if you've ended up homeless and you are living under a bridge? If it's reasonable in one set of circumstances, could there be other circumstances where it's also reasonable? But this blasts a hole in the rudder of the boat the psychiatrists writing the DSM have been sailing in for so long. Suddenly life, with all its complexity, starts to flood into diagnosing depression and anxiety. It can't just be a matter of a chemical imbalance verified by checklists of symptoms. It would have to be seen as a response to your circumstances. As Joanne Cacciatore researched the grief exception in more detail, she came to believe it revealed a basic mistake our culture is making about pain, way beyond grief. We don't, she told me, consider context. We act like human distress can be assessed solely on a checklist that can be separated out from our lives and labelled as brain diseases. As she said this, I told her that in 13 years of being handed ever higher doses of antidepressants, no doctor ever asked me if there was any reason why I might be feeling so distressed. She told me I'm not unusual, and it's a disaster. The message my doctors gave me, that our pain is simply a result of a malfunctioning brain, makes us, she said, disconnected from ourselves, which leads to disconnection from others. If we started to take people's actual lives into account when we treat depression and anxiety, Joanne said, it would require an entire system overhaul. There are many good and decent psychiatrists who want to think in this deeper way, she stressed, and can see the limits of what we're doing right now. Instead of saying our pain is an irrational spasm to be taken away with drugs, they see that we should start to listen to it and figure out what it's telling us. In most cases, Joanne says, we'd have to stop talking about mental health, which conjures pictures of brain scans and defective synapses, and start talking about emotional health. Why do we call it mental health, she asked me? Because we want to scientize it. We want to make it sound scientific. But it's our emotions. She approaches her patients, she says, not with a checklist, but by saying, tell me your story. Oh my gosh, how hard. I'd probably feel the same way if I was in your situation. I'd probably have the same set of symptoms. Let's look at context. Sometimes, all you can do for a person is hold them. The mother whose daughter was burned alive came to see Joe one day, howling and screaming with pain. Joe sat on the floor and held her and let the pain come out. And after it did, the mother felt some relief for a time because she knew she was not alone. Sometimes, that's the most we can do. It's a lot. And sometimes, when you listen to the pain and you see it in its context, it will point you to a way beyond it, as I learned later. Our approach today is, Joanne said, like putting a band-aid on an amputated limb. When you have a person with extreme human distress, we need to stop treating the symptoms. The symptoms are a messenger of a deeper problem. Let's get to the deeper problem. For decades then, there was a tension at the heart of the psychiatric Bible. The public was being told two clashing things. First, the symptoms of depression are straightforwardly the result of a chemical imbalance in the brain that has to be fixed with drugs. Second, that somehow, and at the same time, there was one unique situation where all the symptoms of depression were in fact a response to something terrible happening in your life, and in that one unique case, a chemical imbalance is not the cause and drugs are not the solution. This tension unsettled a lot of people. It begged too many questions. People like Joanne could use it to force debates onto the table that many people didn't want to have. So the psychiatrist who wrote the fifth and most recent edition of the DSM, which was published in 2015, came up with a solution. They got rid of the grief exception. In the new version, it's not there. There's just the checklist of symptoms, followed by a vague footnote. So now, if your baby dies, and you go to the doctor the next day, and you're in extreme distress, you can be diagnosed immediately, Joanne explained to me. And so the model is preserved. Depression is something you can find on a checklist. If you tick the boxes, you're mentally ill. Don't look for context. Look for symptoms. Don't ask what's happening in the person's life. Thinking like this, Joanne told me, makes her believe that we're such an utterly disconnected culture, we just don't get human suffering. She looked at me, and I thought of everything she's gone through and the wisdom it's given her. She blinked and said, we just don't get it. A long time after I spoke with Joanne, and after I carried out much more research, I listened again to the audio of my interview with her. I was beginning to think there was something significant about the fact that grief and depression have identical symptoms. Then one day, after interviewing several depressed people, I asked myself, what if depression is in fact a form of grief for our own lives not being as they should? What if it is a form of grief for the connections we've lost, yet still need? But to understand how I came to ask that question, we need to step back to a moment when there was a key breakthrough in the scientific understanding of depression and anxiety. Chapter 4, The First Flag on the Moon. In the days after the Second World War, a young woman in her early 20s, fresh from giving birth, walked through the ruins of Kensal Rise. It was a crowded working-class suburb of West London, and parts of it had been reduced by the Nazis to rubble. She was finding her way to the Grand Canal. Once she got there, she threw herself into its dust-choked waters. In the months and years that followed her suicide, nobody talked about her depression. There was silence. It was taboo to ask why people became desperately distressed in this way. In a house not far away, there was a teenage boy named George Brown. The woman who had died had been a close neighbour, and when he'd developed a rumbling infection in a world without antibiotics, she'd looked after him for months in those poor, cramped houses. She was a very warm person, he told me, 71 years later, smiling at her memory. So this is one of my earliest experiences. There were very strong feelings associated at that time, shame with depression. He repeated this later. There was a great deal of shame associated with it. It was hushed up, really, he added. This puzzled him, although he didn't think about it deeply again until he was 36 years old and about to make a remarkable discovery. In the early 1970s, George returned to a working-class London neighbourhood, very like the one he'd grown up in, to investigate a mystery. Why did so many people like his neighbour sink into deep depression? What causes it? At the time, there was still a silence hanging over not only this individual victim, but the whole society. When depression was discussed by professionals, far from the public gaze, there was a split between two contrasting ways of thinking about it. You could picture it crudely as a division between, on the one side, a patient lying on a sofa in front of the founder of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud, and on the other side, a dissected brain. The Freudians have been arguing for almost a century that the explanation for this kind of distress could only be found in the depressed person's personal life, and particularly in their early childhood. The only way to deal with this was to explore it through one-on-one therapy, through which you could piece together the story of what had happened and find a better story for the patient to tell about her life. As a backlash against this way of thinking, many psychiatrists have started to argue in contrast that depression was just something going wrong with a person's brain or body, an internal malfunction, and so searching for deeper reasons in her life story in this way was missing the point. It was clearly a physical problem with a physical cause. George had always suspected that there was some truth in both these perspectives, but that neither told the whole story. There seemed, he thought, to be more to this question, but what? He'd been trained not as a doctor or psychiatrist, but as an anthropologist, a profession in which you observe a culture as an outsider and try to figure out how it works. This meant, he told me, that he arrived at the psychiatric treatment centre he was going to work out of in South London, completely ignorant of what you're supposed to think about something like depression, and he now believes that was a great advantage. I had no preconceived ideas, so I was forced to have an open mind. He started to read over the science that had been carried out up to that point, and it struck him that very little data had been gathered. It seemed to me, he remembers, there was a lot of ignorance. The theories were being formulated largely in the dark. They were based either on personal anecdotes or on abstract theories. The studies that had already been done seemed to be fairly inadequate, he said. By then, the official medical position on depression was to cut the baby in half between these two warring factions. The mainstream scientific community had declared there were two kinds of depression. The first kind was caused by your brain or body starting to spontaneously malfunction. They named this endogenous depression. But there were also, they said, some forms of depression caused by something bad happening in your personal life, which they named reactive depression. Yet nobody knew what people with reactive depression were meant to be reacting to, or where the line between these two different kinds of depression was, or even if it was a distinction that made any sense. To find the real story, George concluded, you had to do something that nobody had ever done before on a significant scale. You had to conduct a proper scientific investigation into depressed or highly anxious people, using techniques a little like those you'd use to, say, figure out why cholera spreads or how pneumonia is contracted. So he began to draw up plans. In the South London district of Camberwell, as George walked through its streets, the thrum of the city seemed a world away. It was only 2 miles from central London, but the only thing that could convince you of that was the spire of St Paul's Cathedral in the distance. He would stroll past some beautiful large Victorian houses, and then through old slum streets that were being abandoned one by one as they were demolished by the government. The working-class row houses he'd known as a kid were being cleared out and knocked down to make way for the big concrete high-rise blocks that were starting to pierce the London skyline. As he arrived at one woman's house, She told them she had to have fire engines come to her house three times that week, because as the streets were being evacuated, kids were setting fire to the rubble. Through the local psychiatric services, George had arranged to carry out an unprecedented research project. The plan was that for many years, he and his team would follow and get to know two different groups of women. The first group consisted of women who had been diagnosed with depression by their psychiatrists. There were 114 of them, and the team's job was to interview them in depth, at home, and gather some key facts about them. In particular, they wanted to look at what happened to them in the year before they had become depressed. That period was crucial, for reasons you'll see in a moment. At the same time, they randomly selected a second group, 344 so-called normal women from Camberwell, in the same income group, who had not been classed as depressed. They repeatedly interviewed them in depth at their homes too, to see what good and bad things were happening in their lives over a typical year. The key to figuring out what causes depression, George suspected, would lie in comparing these two groups. Imagine if you investigated something genuinely random, like being hit by a meteor. If you studied what happens to the people who got hit by meteors in the year leading up to their accident, and compared them to a typical year in the life of people who don't get hit by meteors, you'd find they were just the same. It has nothing to do with any wider factors in their lives. They're just victims of a rock falling from space. Lots of people thought then, and think now, that depression and anxiety are like that. It's just a random piece of chemical bad luck happening inside your skull rather than in your life. This research could prove if they were right. If they were, then George would find no difference between the depressed women's lives and the non-depressed women's lives in that key year leading up to the onset of depression. But what if there were a difference? If you could find out what the difference was, George knew that would reveal something really important. It could give us clues about what causes depression. Was it only that the early childhoods or personal lives of the depressed women had gone wrong, as the Freudians said? Or was something else going on? If so, what was it? So George and his team, including a young researcher and therapist named Tyrrell Harris, went to all these women's houses and sat with them and got to know them. They interviewed them in great detail. Then when they left, they graded these women's lives very carefully, using complex data gathering and statistical methods they had agreed on at the start of the study. They were building up a database of an enormous range of factors. Anything they suspected might even conceivably play a role in depression. One day, Tyrrell went to see a woman living on the ground floor of a typical two-bedroom house in the neighbourhood named Mrs. Trent. She was married to a van driver, and they lived in this small house with their three kids, who were all under seven. By the time Tyrrell met her, she said she couldn't concentrate at all, not even long enough to read an article in the morning paper. She was losing her interest in eating or having sex. Most of the day, she wept. She felt like her body was physically locking up with tension, but she didn't know why. For 6 weeks, she'd just been going to bed during the day and staying there inert, hoping the world would go away. As they got to know Mrs. Trent, they discovered that something had happened not long before she became depressed. Just after their third kid was born, Mr. Trent had lost his job. His wife wasn't too worried, and he got another job a few weeks later. But then he was abruptly fired for no apparent reason. She became convinced that his reference from his old boss had come through and it was bad. He couldn't find another job. Since it was taboo in Camberwell at that time for mothers to work, that meant the family was chronically insecure. How were they going to live? The marriage was finished, she told George and Tyrrell. But what could she do? She kept packing her bags and leaving, but she never got beyond the end of the street. Where could she go? What I recall was how moving these interviews could be, George told me when I went to see him. These women on the whole weren't used to talking about themselves. Here was someone who showed interest in them and someone who had allowed them to talk. He could see it meant something to the women on the whole. Also, as he said, the stories they told made sense. They knew they were suffering and in trouble. Many of the women they met were like Mrs. Trent, and neither of the two models of depression that had existed up to then seemed sufficient to describe her. Perhaps there was a problem in her brain and body. There certainly was a problem in her personal life, but it seemed likely to George that her depression had been activated by something bigger, but they couldn't be sure how to describe it until they had the results. The first thing they wanted to know about these women was, had they experienced any severe losses or really negative events in the year before they became depressed. The women often describe going through a whole range of horrible events, from a son going to prison, to a husband being diagnosed as schizophrenic, to a baby being born seriously disabled. George and Tyrrell were strict about what they classified as severe in their data. One woman said her dog had been like a child to her, as she built her life around him and he died, but they hadn't classified the loss of a pet as a severe event, so they left it out. At the same time, they want to look at the other things they suspected could affect someone's mental health over time, but don't really count as a one-off event. They divided them into two categories. They labelled the first category difficulties, which they defined as a chronic ongoing problem, which could range from having a bad marriage, to living in bad housing, to being forced to move away from your community and neighbourhood. The second category looked at the exact opposite, stabilisers, the things that they suspected could boost you and protect you from despair. For that, they carefully recorded how many close friends the women had and how good their relationships with their partners were. After years of patiently gathering their evidence, talking to woman after woman, and returning to them over long intervals, the team finally sat down and crunched the numbers. They spent months figuring out what the data revealed. As they did this, they felt a weight of responsibility. This was the first time scientific evidence had ever been gathered in this way. If the story I was told by my doctor when I was a teenager, that depression is caused simply by low serotonin levels in the brain, rather than by anything happening in your life, is true, then there will be no difference between these two groups. Tyrrell stared at the results. Among the women who didn't develop depression, some 20% had experienced a significant negative event in the preceding year. Among the women who did develop depression, some 68% of them had experienced a significant negative event in the year before the depression set in. It was a gap of 48%, far more than could be caused by chance. This showed that experiencing something really stressful can cause depression. But this was only the first of their findings. It turned out depressed women were 3 times more likely to be facing serious long-term stresses in their life in the year before they developed their depression than women who didn't get depressed. It wasn't just a bad event that caused depression. It was also long-term sources of stress. And if you had some positive stabilizing things in your life, that massively reduced the chances of developing depression. For every good friend you had, or if your partner was more supportive and caring, it reduced depression by a remarkable amount. So George and Tyrrell had discovered 2 things that make depression much more likely: having a severe negative event and having long-term sources of stress and insecurity in your life. But the most startling result was what happened when these factors were added together. Your chances of becoming depressed didn't just combine, they exploded. For example, if you didn't have any friends and you didn't have a supportive partner, your chances of developing depression when a severe negative event came along were 75%. It was much more likely than not. It turned out that every bad thing that happened to you, every source of stress, every lack of support, each one accelerated the risk of depression more and more. It was like putting a fungus in a place that's dark and wet. It wouldn't just grow more than it would in a place that was just dark or a place that was just wet. It would balloon bigger than both combined. George hadn't expected to find such a huge effect. As they tried to absorb these results, they thought back over the women they'd got to know over all these years. They had proved that depression is in fact, to a significant degree, a problem not with your brain, but with your life. After it was published, one professor, summarizing the general understanding, called it a quantum leap ahead. We are told in our culture that depression is the ultimate form of irrationality. That's how it feels from the inside. And that's how it looks to the outside. But on the contrary, George and Tyrrell were reaching the conclusion that, as they wrote then, clinical depression is an understandable response to adversity. Think about Mrs. Trent, trapped in a dead marriage with a man who couldn't get work, scrambling to survive with no chance of a better life. She was being given a guarantee that her life would be a stressful, joyless scramble forever. Didn't it make more sense, they wondered, to say that the fault for her depression lay in the environment, rather than in the person? As I read this, I could see the force of their logic, but I had an obvious objection. I wasn't living in a run-down housing project in the worst part of London. Not now, nor at any point in my depression. My life had never been like Mrs. Trent's. Most of the people I knew who were depressed weren't living in poverty either. What did their findings mean for people like us? As they crunched the numbers, George and Tyrrell had discovered people living in poverty were more likely to become depressed, but the data showed it was too crude to show that poverty caused the depression. No, something more subtle was happening. People in poverty were more likely to become depressed because on average they faced more long-term stress and because more negative life events happened to them and because they had fewer stabilizers. But the underlying lessons were true for everyone, rich, middle class or poor. We all lose some hope when we're subjected to severe stress or when something horrible happens to us. But if the stress or the bad events are sustained over a long period, then what you get is the generalization of hopelessness, Tyrrell told me. It spreads out over your whole life, like an oil slick, and you begin to want to give up. Years later, teams of social scientists used the exact same techniques as George and Tyrrell to investigate the causes of depression in places as radically different as the Basque Country and rural Zimbabwe. And what they discovered is that these factors were driving depression or protecting people from it everywhere. In rural Spain, depression was extremely low, because there was a strong community protecting people and few traumatic experiences. In Zimbabwe, depression was extremely high because people faced traumatic experiences often. For example, if you were a woman and you couldn't have a child, you could just be expelled from your home and your community. I went to rural Zimbabwe while I was researching this book and I saw this for myself. Wherever you were in the world, researchers were learning, these factors played a crucial role in whether you would become depressed or not. They seem to have discovered the beginnings of the secret recipe for what is really contained in depression. And yet, even after all this work, George and Tyrrell knew there was still something they couldn't see in this picture. What was it? When George and Tyrrell published their results, there was a rapid response from some psychiatrists. They claimed, look, we always said some people become depressed because of events in their life. Those are the people with reactive depression. Okay, so you've refined what we know about them. Kudos to you. But there's still a huge category of people who are depressed for internal physical reasons. Those are the people with endogenous depression. All that's happening to them is that something is malfunctioning internally. But George and Tyrrell explained they had all along been studying women who had been classified by psychiatrists as having reactive depression and women classified as having endogenous depression. What they found when they compared the evidence is there was no difference between them. Both groups had things going wrong in their lives at the same rate. This distinction, they concluded, was meaningless. I mean, it seems incredible now, really, to think that we had to convince people that life events were relevant to depression and anxiety, you know? Tyrrell Harris, the co-author of this research, said to me in the office where she still practices therapy in North London. I asked her what she would say to the people who think that depression is solely caused internally by the brain, as my generation was told by our doctors. She furrowed her brow. No organism exists without the environment. So it just can't be, she said. I think they're just a bit ignorant, that's all, she said. She smiled at me patiently. I mean, there's an awful lot of people in the world who have ill-founded opinions, and one gets used to it. Years later, Tyrrell used the same technique to carry out a study of anxiety and found similar results. It wasn't just a problem caused by the brain going wrong. It was caused by life going wrong. George and Tyrrell believed their research on the streets of South London had only scratched the surface. There was so much more to ask. They were acutely conscious that there were lots of factors in the lives of depressed and anxious people that they didn't look at. What should be studied next? They were planting the first flag on the moon of investigating the social causes of depression and anxiety. They expected other spaceships to follow soon, to carry out other probes. And then, so far as communicating these ideas to the public went, there was silence. The other spacecraft never came. Their flag was left in windless space. The public debate about depression shifted within a few years to the discovery of the new antidepressant drugs and how to prevent depression inside the brain rather than out here in society. The conversation shifted from figuring out what is making us so unhappy in our lives to trying to block the neurotransmitters in the brain that allow us to feel it. Yet in one limited sense, George and Tyrrell won. Within a few years, the evidence that environmental factors are a key part of depression and anxiety was steadily building up among academics, until in most scientific circles it became undeniable. These findings soon ended up as a key part of the basis for psychiatric training in many parts of the Western world. most mainstream training courses began to teach that these forms of mental distress, such as depression and anxiety, have three kinds of cause: biological, psychological, and social. They're all real. This is known as the biopsychosocial model. It's simple. All three sets of factors are relevant, and to understand a person's depression and anxiety, you need to look at them all. But these truer insights remain private, sealed off from a public who could have been helped by them. They weren't explained to the swelling ranks of depressed and anxious people, and they didn't shape the treatment that was offered to them. The public was never told about the biggest implication of this research. George and Tyrrell had concluded that when it comes to depression and anxiety, as they put it, paying attention to a person's environment may turn out to be at least as effective as physical treatment. Nobody asked them, how do we do that? What environmental changes would reduce depression and anxiety? These questions seem too big, too revolutionary to process. They are still ignored today, although later I began to explore what they could mean. That research in Camberwell, I realise now, was a moment when the whole history of understanding depression could have gone in a radically different direction. Their research was published in 1978, the year before I was born. If the world had listened to George and Tyrrell, when I went to my doctor 18 years after the publication of their research, he would have had to tell me a very different story about why I was in such pain and how to find my way back. When I said goodbye to George Brown, after one of our long conversations, he told me that he would be spending the rest of his day working on his latest scientific paper, digging further into the causes of depression. By the time I met him, he was 85 years old, so he said it would probably be his last research project. But he is not stopping. As he walked away, I pictured his neighbour, drowning herself all those years ago in silence. There is so much, George had told me, that we still need to know. Why would he stop now? Part 2. Disconnection. 9 Causes of Depression and Anxiety. Chapter 5. Picking Up the Flag. An Introduction to Part 2. After learning all this, I began to follow the trail that led from George Brown and Tyrrell Harris's research out across the world. I wanted to know, who else has studied the seemingly hidden dimensions of depression and anxiety, and what does that mean for how we might reduce them? Over the next few years, I found out that all across the world, there are social scientists and psychologists who have been picking up George and Tyrrell's tattered flag. I sat with them from San Francisco to Sydney, from Berlin to Buenos Aires, and I came to think of them as a kind of depression and anxiety underground, piecing together a more complex and truthful story. It was a long time into talking with these social scientists that I realized every one of the social and psychological causes of depression and anxiety they've discovered has something in common. They are all forms of disconnection. They are all ways in which we've been cut off from something we innately need but seem to have lost along the way. After researching depression and anxiety for several years now, I've been able to identify 9 causes. I want to stress I'm not saying these are the only causes of depression and anxiety. There will be more that has not yet been discovered or that I didn't come across in my research. I'm also not saying that every depressed or anxious person will find all of these factors in their lives. For example, I experienced some of them, but not all. But following this trail was going to change how I thought about some of my own deepest feelings. Chapter 6. Cause 1. Disconnection from meaningful work. Joe Phillips was waiting for the day to end. If you'd walked into the paint shop in Philadelphia where he worked, and you asked for a gallon of paint in a particular shade, he would ask you to pick it from a chart and he would prepare it for you. It was always the same. He would put a dash of pigment into the can and put the can into a machine that looked a bit like a microwave, and the machine would shake it vigorously. This made the colour of the paint even. Then he would take your money and say, "Thank you, sir." Then he'd wait for the next customer and do the same thing. And then he'd wait for the next customer and do the same thing. All day, every day. Take an order. Shake paint. Say, "Thank you, sir." Wait. Take an order. Shake paint. Say, "Thank you, sir." Wait. And on. And on. Nobody ever noticed whether Joe did it well or badly. The only thing his boss ever commented on is if he was late, and then he'd get bawled out. As Joe left work, he would always think, I don't feel like I made a difference in anyone's life. The attitude of his employers, he told me, was, you're going to do it this way, and you're going to show up at this time, and as long as you do that, you're fine. But he found himself thinking, as he put it to me, where's the ability to change? Where's the ability to grow? Where's the ability to really make an impact on this company that I'm working for? Because anyone could just show up on time, do what they tell you to do. Joe felt like his human thoughts and insights and feelings were almost a defect. But whenever he told me about how his work made him feel, as we ate dinner in a Chinese restaurant, Joe would chastise himself soon afterward. There's people out there who would die for this job, and I understand that. I'm grateful for it, he said. It was reasonably paid. He could live with his girlfriend in an okay place. He knew plenty of people who didn't have any of that. He felt guilty for feeling this way. But then the feelings kept coming back. And he shook more paint. And he shook more paint. And he shook more paint. So the monotony is lying in the fact that you constantly feel you're doing things you don't want to do, he told me. Where's the joy at? I'm not intellectual enough to be able to explain it. But there was just an overall feeling that you needed something to fill that void, although you couldn't ever put your finger on what that void really was. He would leave home at 7 in the morning, work all through the day, and get home at 7 at night. He began to wonder, you go through this 40 to 50 hour work week, and if you don't really like it, you're just setting yourself up for depression and anxiety, and questioning, why am I doing this? There's got to be something better than this. He started to feel, he said, that there was no hope. What's the point? You've got to be challenged in a healthy way, he said, shrugging a little. I think he felt embarrassed to say it. You have to know that your voice counts. You have to know that if you have a good idea, you can speak up and change something. He had never had a job like that, and he feared he never would. If you spend so many of your waking hours deadening yourself to get through the day, it's hard, he explained, to turn that off and be engaged with the people you love when you get home. Joe would have 5 hours to himself before he had to sleep and then shake paint again. He wanted to just collapse in front of the TV, or to be alone. On weekends, all he wanted to do was drink a lot and watch a game. Joe contacted me one day because he'd listened to some of my speeches online, and he wanted to talk about the subject of my last book, which was, in part, addiction. We arranged to meet and walk through the streets of Philadelphia before we ate. There, he told me a story. After years of shaking paint, Joe went one night to a casino with one of his friends, and he was offered a little blue pill by one of them. It was 30 milligrams of the opiate-based painkiller OxyContin. Joe took it and felt pleasantly numbed. And a few days later, he thought, maybe this would help me at work. When he took it, he felt the fading of those feelings that had been flooding his head. Before long, I made sure I had them before I went to work, made sure I had enough with me at work to get through work rationing them out, he says. He would take some more when he got home with some beers, thinking, I can deal with that bullshit at work knowing that when I come home, I get to do this. And he shook more paint. And he shook more paint. And he shook more paint. I wondered if this was because the oxy made him as blank and empty as the job itself. It seemed to dissolve the conflict between his desire to make a difference and the reality of his life. When I started talking to Joe, he thought at first that he was telling me a story about addiction. He'd been told by the people he went to for help kicking the oxy that he was born an addict, and that's the story he told me at first. But when we talked about it some more, he said he'd had periods of pretty heavy drinking, weed smoking, and the odd line of cocaine as a college student, and he'd never felt any urge to use them more than at occasional parties. It was only when he entered a deadening job and saw it as a dead end that he started to numb himself. And when he did kick the oxy, after a few rough months, his sense that his life was unbearable came back. All the thoughts that he'd been trying to get away from recurred as he shook the paint again and again. He knew that people needed paint, he told me. He added once again that he knew he should be grateful, but he said he couldn't stand the thought that his life would be like this for another 35 years until he retired. Like, you like what you do, right? He said to me. I stopped writing in my notebook for a moment. When you wake up in the morning, you look forward to your day. When I wake up, I don't look forward to work. It's just something I have to do. Between 2011 and 2012, the polling company Gallup conducted the most detailed study ever carried out of how people across the world feel about their work. they studied millions of workers across 142 countries. They found that 13% of people say they are engaged in their jobs, which means they are enthusiastic about and committed to their work and contribute to their organization in a positive manner. Against them, 63% say they are not engaged, which is defined